Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. My guest today is Veda Manager, who's led a fascinating career across a range of corporate, government, and nonprofit organizations, where he's held various leadership, board, and consulting roles. I'm excited to speak with Veda today to learn how his broad experience has shaped his view of leadership. And I'm particularly interested in any leadership lessons from his experience working with legendary leaders like Phil Knight, Bruce Babbitt, and Nelson Mandela. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Hi, Veda. It's so great to see you.
Great, Meryl. It's great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you, and welcome to the Let Go and Lead podcast. I'm so excited because you have such an interesting and eclectic career path. I mean, you've had leadership roles in all size companies, all sectors of the industry, many types of industries, and through government, corporations, nonprofits, consulting firms. So I'm really going to be interested in hearing what you've learned about all this. And, you know, I didn't even cover it all. I mean, you're a documentary producer, a television commentator, and an investor, and you've served on multiple boards. So I'm sure you have a thousand leadership lessons for us, but I'd love to start with the fact that at the young age of 21, you were asked to join the Arizona Board of Regents. How did that happen?
Well, thank you again. Thanks for having me. Maybe with that introduction, maybe that's why my mother has a tough kind of distinguishing kind of what I do for a living. But she's seen it from a long career horizon of all the things I've been involved in. The Arizona Board of Regents, Meryl, was probably one of the most both serendipitous and fortuitous moments of my life. That's the position that a student at the university, at that time I was a student at Arizona State University, a junior, and every year there's a rotational position on the Arizona Board of Regents, which is the policy and financial making board for the state's universities. And one student is allowed a seat on that board to represent all of the 100,000 at that time in the 80s, 100,000 plus students in the state. And so you're sitting there with the CEOs of utility companies and the owner of the Phoenix Suns and medical directors and people who were 30, 40 years older than I was at 20 years old as a junior in college. But for me, that was probably the start of my journey in terms of understanding how to broker relationships, build consensus, how to play at a level beyond what my years were. We had a saying at Nike, be a sponge. So as much as I contributed the student perspective, I tried to be a sponge to absorb all these lessons from all these accomplished leaders I was sitting around the table. And I would say one of the greatest compliments at the end of my year term there, Meryl, was the fact that I came in as a neophyte, as a newbie. By the end of that year, I was elected as secretary of the board in a leadership position. So I felt as if that I made an impact, and they recognized that impact by making me an officer of the board, not just a person sitting there.
That's incredible. And, you know, I'm curious, is a young person going in and working with all those sort of legendary figures that you just mentioned, I assume you had a certain expectation of what that would be like. And I'm wondering now, looking back, what would you say to that young self?
Yeah, good question. I would say trust your instincts is certainly one. And something I often say to graduate school classes, undergraduate classes, as well as even convocations and graduation speeches I deliver is be sure that you build relationships and rely upon the expertise of others. Don't be afraid to ask questions and to seek out knowledge, but also don't go into those settings unprepared, because the worst reputation you can have, and we know this in business and you know this in the agency world, is you'll lose credibility very, very fast if you're unprepared walking through such a situation. In fact, you're coming in with a deficit of expectation. So in many ways, you need to overprepare and overcompensate for the perceptions that people are going to have walking in the room.
And you've had so many different first starts, right? Like, you've worked for governors, you've worked for consulting firms, all these different things that we talked about before. So One of the things I'd love to talk to you about is some of the leaders that you've actually had the opportunity to serve, because they're people all of us would love to know more about. So let's talk a little bit about two Arizona governors that you actually were on their cabinet and press secretary also to the mayor of Washington, D.C. Can you talk a little bit about Bruce Babbitt or Sharon Pratt?
Yeah, so Governor Babbitt, who later ended up being Secretary of the Interior for President Clinton, was the person actually that appointed me to that Arizona Board of Regents seat that we talked to. So once you applied at the student level, the governor then made a decision out of three students to then appoint a student. So it was as a result of my year and my work with him and that appointment that I ended up joining his cabinet later. So he was a fascinating individual, very intellectual, very erudite. We still stay in touch today. Really just a fascinating individual. Marched in Selma and Bloody Sunday. So a lot of my leadership lessons came from him initially. And now doing this documentary that you referenced earlier about Stuart Udall, who was one of his predecessors as the Secretary of Interior, it all kind of comes full circle for me to have been very fortunate to have had all these great individuals in my life. Governor Mofford, a very different individual, someone who started as a secretary in state government back probably in the 40s, to go from that level to then being governor after 50 years in government was a great learning opportunity as well, because she didn't really have time to build a cabinet. She ascended to the office after Governor Evan Meekum, her predecessor, was impeached over some illicit dealings and his refusal to recognize a Martin Luther King holiday, in which Arizona was the last state to adopt such. So Arizona had a Super Bowl pulled. We had artists like Jackson Brown and Stevie Wonder who refused to come and play concerts here in Arizona because of that. So she luckily had all the expertise and relationships and learned a lot from her about relationships.
Was there anything in particular that you saw her do that you've emulated through the years?
Absolutely. It is just the ability to, she sent out a holiday card every year. Now that might seem to be a low-tech, very simple, almost menial and trivial to some people, but her database, and she kept what many young people now know nothing about as a Rolodex. She had these four giant Rolodexes that, in fact, they were so treasured in terms of the notes that were on them, the numbers, the information about people, that when she passed away, she ordered them not to go to anyone. She ordered them destroyed. So that is how much she valued relationships. And quite frankly, I did the same. I learned that early on. Instead of a Rolodex, I had what many people back in college, when a lot of my student friends were going to bars on Friday nights or Saturday night, because I was in all of these unique settings with very interesting and accomplished people. After I went to a reception or a meeting and that, I took all these business cards, and there were no scans, there were no internet during that time. I would manually enter these into what were the primitive databases at that time with a Radio Shack TRS-80. Now, again, that's a reference that many people don't know about, a Radio Shack TRS-80, built my own database. And even to this day, Merrill, with this telephone that I have, this iPhone and devices that we have, I started building that database back in the 80s. And now when I pull up my phone, my database has about 14,000 people in them. And often do that with college classes and that. I'll designate a prize like a gift card or something, $100 gift card to a restaurant. And I do it to make a point. I'll hold up my phone and say, you, how many people do you think I have in this phone? And I'll get guesses. They start at 500. They get 1,200 in that. And when I say the number 14,000, you see mouths drop in the room. But I use it to make a point that building relationships through the year and through your career will come full circle and be valuable to you. Not everybody gets a holiday card on that 14,000 person list, but I will periodically drop an email, drop a note. President George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, was very good at this as well, as we learned from his memoirs and the interviews about his career. He was very good about writing handwritten notes. So those same things might be low tech and seem trivial, but over the years, they do pay dividends. And it genuinely helps if you authentically like people, which I do.
Well, and you do seem extraordinarily good at it. I remember when we recently bumped into each other in New York, and right away, you knew who I was. And we hadn't seen each other in several years, so I was quite impressed.
Well, you know, it also helped that your name was on the invitation, but I did know who you were, you know, Meryl. You can't forget the inimitable, incomparable Meryl, you know, so.
Well, I'll take that as the true compliment it is, so thank you.
It is, that it is.
How about working with Jody Powell and Sheila Tate, I think, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. They had the firm Powell Tate, again, another just great experience for me. Jody was legendary as the White House press secretary for President Carter. He put me in and trusted my instincts. And actually, so again, for young people and young professionals that might be listening to this, make sure that the assignments that you take, even if they're not the most treasured assignments in the firm or the treasured assignments that other people have, try to see the value in them and how they're going to build upon things you might do in the future. So Jody put me on assignments to help work out the PGA Tour, which was having some antitrust issues. Now, if those are familiar to you, let's think about what's happening today. The PGA Tour, the Professional Golfers Association for the professionals, is now under all kinds of scrutiny because of their deal with the LIV Tour, which is backed by the Saudis. Back then, we actually had to deal with that issue because Greg Norman, who represents the current LIV Tour, was trying to start a rival tour to the PGA Tour, and we helped represent the PGA Tour to, shall we say, arrest that process because it would have been devastating to our client at the time. So I learned a lot from Jody, and he also put me on the Major League Baseball player strike, which they had all kinds of labor issues with the owners. So think about being in the room with luminaries like George Steinbrenner, the legendary boss of the Yankees, or Jerry Reinsdorf, who still owns the Chicago White Sox. You're in Chicago, you know that, and the Chicago Bulls. Being in the room with them trying to negotiate labor deals and salary deals, those are all experiences I had in my 20s and 30s working with Jody and Sheila. So I owe them a lot in terms of, and that experience then led to that issue experience of hardcore labor negotiations, understanding issues. Then that having that on my resume led me to Nike to join the C-suite and advise Phil Knight, which many of you have probably seen the movie on Air. You know, Phil was obviously legendary and created the industry of sports marketing. So every earlier experience builds on the next, which might build up on the next. And now I own small equity positions in NBA franchises. So you can see the sequence over the years of trying to be sure that one experience early builds upon the next, builds upon the next.
In working with Phil Knight, what are some of the insights you can give us there? Like we have a lot of listeners who are senior level managers working with the C-suite and in the C-suite. So what were some things you saw that you could share that would be helpful?
You know, I think the biggest lesson that impacted my trajectory and sentiments around working at Nike and working directly with Phil a lot was, it is something that's in the what's called the Nike Maxims, which are kind of the operating principles for every leader at the company, which is be on the offense always, meaning that Nike is a company that doesn't play defense very well. It tries to lead the consumer to where the consumer doesn't even know that it wants to go. So that's in Nike's DNA of creating the sports marketing industry, identifying the right athletes who are going to represent the brand, creating the right innovative, novel products that the consumer doesn't even know right now that it wants and is going to change and be valuable to their lives. So I think that's a lesson that we can extrapolate to all of our lives, whether you're junior or senior in going forward, which is try to be definitional and innovative. And also, again, as I said earlier, it's not always the glamorous assignments. I had probably the most unglamorous assignment at Nike, which was to help kind of turn around the whole labor practices, sweatshop, child labor issues at Nike, which was something everybody wanted to go hang out with Michael Jordan and Andre Agassi and all the brand name athletes. But, you know, I had kind of the tough work. But had I not taken that assignment, Meryl, when I came there, which was not the job I was recruited to come to Nike for, I would not have spent as much time in the C-suite with Phil Knight because it was a need that the company had and it was a problem to be solved. So again, the lesson, again, for whether you're junior in your career or senior in your career, sometime taking that assignment where the likelihood of probability of success either seems low or improbable. If you succeed, it was the great formula for me to be promoted consistently at the company, be placed on the corporate leadership team, and to be also hailed along with my colleague, Kirk Stewart, who you know, and others, to be someone that could be relied upon at the company.
And what do you think it takes in a leader to keep a company always on the offensive?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think it's the consistent learning and the consistent experimentation and not being afraid to fail. Not everything that you're going to put out there is going to be successful. But I think if a organization and a company like Nike is willing to have a certain, shall we say, failure tolerance, and as long as that failure doesn't have lingering or long time, shall we say, implications on the reputation and on the financials of the company, then I think that you can take some risk. And being too risk averse, I think, is not the formula for success then or even now in today's environment. It's those that are willing to innovate and have some risk tolerance, I think, are the ones who are going to be successful and redefined, particularly in this new day of artificial intelligence, et cetera, where things are just happening so fast.
And how did Nike encourage people to take risks? You know, because it's interesting, I think often from the outside, it looks like Nike's all about winning.
It is all about winning, but I think it's a very flat matrixed organization. So one of the ways I think they do win and encourage risk taking is because it's so flat, literally, Merrill, the person who would come in and empty my trash receptacle was eligible to apply for a job to advance their career at Nike and eligible to advance a idea about a new shoe design or a better way of operating. So when you have that flat of an organization and people feel as if no matter what level you're at the company that can socialize a new idea and to bring something forward to add value, then I think you've got an empowered culture and one that is not command and control and you're poised for winning in that way. And as I mentioned earlier, the being a sponge of not always talking, but listening is a great way of operating.
That's a really interesting concept to think about, like the gentleman helping you empty the trash, designing a new shoe. And, you know, it's kind of that whole idea that great ideas come from anywhere, right? And that leaders should be hosts, not heroes.
So that young woman, by the way, who used to empty my trash receptacle, I am now connected on LinkedIn with her, and she is at a manager level at Nike. And that this is some 10 years later. So I'm so proud of her for understanding what kind of organization she was working for. And because I was usually in the office 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night, we'd see each other and we'd talk.
Yeah.
And she would unveil her ambitions. So I'm so proud to be connected with Nancy on LinkedIn and to see her ascent and continued success at the company.
That's terrific. And thanks for pointing out that it's Nancy and not a gentleman.
No, that's fine. No worries. No. You would have had no way of knowing.
So as you think about your board experiences, what have you seen as some of the most challenging issues in being a board member?
Well, you know, I think being a board member has really evolved, I would say, in the last 5 years. Just ask anyone on the boards of Anheuser-Busch InBev or yeah. Target or any of the organizations right now that are facing major scrutiny about both their reputation and decision-making, as well as how that's impacting their overall revenues and financials. Before boards, I think, were very CEO-driven and chair-driven. Now, I think companies, CEOs, and boards are being asked to assess a wider range of issues, and you have a much more vocal institutional investor base that are asking boards and companies to consider more than just operational excellence. I just was on a board call this morning, and we went over financials, but we're going to be in a strategy meeting next week, and we'll talk about ESG. We'll talk about our environmental and sustainable. We'll talk about our governance. We'll talk about other issues. And I think that has changed the complexion of boards. Boards are more diverse now, I think, than they've ever been. And I intentionally, Merrill, became the governance and nominating chair because I could see the country changing demographically. I can see the country changing in terms of tastes and expectations. I think we've all seen surveys and polling by APCO and by others through Champion Brand and other tools that we have at Gagan McDonald and otherwise that indicate that the consumers want a more engaged company that is more than just about delivering profits. It's about being good corporate citizens and having purpose. So normally boards, members, and directors, I tell those that aspire to boards that ask me for counsel, what is your, how much work is it? And usually it's about 230 hours a year. But that number has crept up considerably because of just the increased demands on directors.
You know, you talked about just the importance of companies in how they are relating to their ESG issues. And of course, that's become rather controversial as of late. How do you actually help a company think about what issues to engage in or whether they should engage at all?
Well, I think it really does start, and you're a seasoned professional. I know many seasoned professionals will be listening to this podcast. Is the best place always to start is what your core values are. A place like Nike, for example, had a very strong culture. Other clients that I have and the board that I'm on, Valvoline, very strong culture. So that is always your operating culture, and your operating principles are the first place to start. And then I think it's important to have kind of a, shall we say, a matrix or a scorecard for evaluating. All right. And I've seen different ones that are very good. One APCO client, Mars, I think has one of the best systems for evaluating, should we engage in this issue? And some of the questions they ask themselves before they engage externally is, can we make a difference on this issue? Is it central to us? Will the issue impact our sector? Does our consumer care about these issues? So all those introspective kind of questions that they ask themselves first before they engage and before they decide to place the company's imprimatur on it are core first. So I think that's the best place to start. And then, you know, there are external organizations such as the Issue Management Council based out of Virginia and the Public Affairs Council as well, all have great tools and scorecards to help companies kind of evaluate whether this is an issue that they ought to engage on. Some issues are brought to you. Some issues are self-inflicted. And you just got to kind of navigate those and have people who are experienced and smart professionals willing to engage in that. And I think that's something also a competency that boards are also adding, which are people who are, again, just not just CEOs or CFOs, but people who have experience in boards. HBO's CCO wrote a great op-ed, I think, in PR Week, if you haven't seen it or your listeners haven't seen it, about making the case why more CCOs and people with our expertise ought to be on boards.
And we're seeing more and more of that, I know. So what are you seeing in terms of what really strong leaders are doing and leading in really uncertain times?
Well, I think it is, you're right to point out that these are unique and even more divided times. And I think the average length of, if I'm not mistaken, of a CEO of a major company is about 6 years, but I think that's even compacting even more because CEOs are being asked to perform so much more than they have in the past and facing so many more issues, not only just internally, but from also external institutional shareholders. I think the best thing a leader can do during these tumultuous and unique times are to stay curious, one, to surround yourself both with a board and internal team that has a broader perspective than just the narrow perspective of what that company is about and what it does, but can bring in other, don't be too insular, bring in other resources. Yeah. I think that was one of the great mistakes that Nike made initially in, and I'm not saying anything out of school. I think they readily admit when in retrospect about when they were dealing initially with the whole sweatshop child labor issue is that they thought they were doing the right thing. They relied upon their contractors and their internal team to say they were doing the right thing. But they never had a stakeholder forum to bring in external parties to say, all right, how do you view us? What do you think we should be doing? And to take that input. And what that does is that you get new idea capital. People feel as if they're bought in by advising the CEO and the company on how to solve this issue because you do have mutuality of need about how to solve this issue. And I think that people, when they're under attack, become somewhat insular. So I think the worst thing to do in that instance is to become insular, is to don't be afraid to invite in alternate voices, and not just friendly voices, but alternate voices to have a critical self-assessment. The IT team now hires hackers to hack their systems in order to understand where their vulnerabilities are in terms of systems and SAP. I think companies would be wise to bring in external voices to kind of hack their reputation or hack their ESG to understand kind of how they're being viewed in the external world out there.
And I couldn't agree more. And I think you also bring up a good point of asking for help. I think many of us of our generation, as we went through business school, we were taught you have to have all the answers, right? And not to ask for help.
Right.
And as you say, the job is so much more complex now. No one person can do it themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the rules I had, and I think maybe I was able to impose this rule because I had such an early leadership start, but I certainly maintain this rule. And you know, our good friend Marjorie Krauss can tell you this as well. When I got sent to Abu Dhabi on assignment or other areas she's dispatched me in around the world, is one of the things I always said to the CEOs I've worked with was, don't ever send me out to defend what I didn't help to define. And what that means is I always got to be at the table to help shape a policy and to have input into how we're developing the strategy and what the vulnerabilities are before you send me out to a microphone to say, either we did this well or we didn't do it well. One of the things I said to Phil Knight and was very honest with him when I got brought into Nike to work with Kirk and our team on turning around kind of the sweatshop issue is that this is not going to be an overnight issue. You didn't get into it overnight. It's central to your business model. I think it's going to take 5 to 7 years before we end up back on social responsible investing lists and unions and other NGO groups begin to adopt us. And I got to say, collectively, along with the help of APCO and smart teammates and a lot of teamwork, we moved Nike from being seen as a pariah in the world to a paragon of corporate responsibility. But one of the things I said to Phil early on was it's going to take 5 to 7 years. And again, something else I often say to CEOs as well is you don't U-turn the Queen Mary around like a Corvette. It's got to be a measured approach in terms of strategy and building credibility and working with stakeholder groups in order to achieve. And it's not going to be a quick fix. And I think AB InBev is going to learn that in terms of having lost their market position. Other companies that are facing crises are going to have to learn that as well.
What's been your experience in working with CEOs when you are counseling them on something they don't want to do?
The good thing about working with CEOs, usually when I'm brought into the table, is that their companies and their boards and their associates have been so beat up that at that particular point, they're usually helpful and very glad to have kind of the quote unquote cavalry coming. So that gives you some degree, I would say, of instant credibility to affect change. And almost like we measure new presidents when they take over the White House, that first 100 days is crucial. I try to make that first 100 days of counseling a new CEO that crucial period to put some points on the board and to show organizations measurable improvement. Because if you don't show something within that 100 days, people will think either it's more flash in the pan or it's not going to work or otherwise. People need to see, even if it's just the smallest metric or the smallest accomplishment of moving things forward, it's important for morale and it's important to demonstrate that kind of progress. So I think I usually try to come to consensus with that CEO or board. What kind of victories can we impact or accomplishments can we take early on in order to show progress? Then that allows you to get the bigger things done.
It's like the old don't let a crisis go to waste, right?
That's true too.
Have you had an experience where you were working with a company where things looked like they were going well from the outside, but you had a sense that if we didn't do something differently, we would ruin our reputation? I'm not asking you to name a company, but you know, I think a lot of our listeners, or many of them, are in situations where they're seeing around the corner and wanting to help the C-suite know we need to shift. And I was just wondering if you had any advice on, in terms of how to do that.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. One is it's important, I think, to build at your company early detection mechanisms, issue management capability, whether it might even just be someone's halftime job, but to have a process at the company that you can identify issues early. Because the worst thing you want at a company is to have what should be a normal course of the matter business issue evolve or metamorphize into a full-blown crisis because you missed the early warning signs. So that's usually the best advice I give pre-crisis to companies is make sure you have that kind of early detection system in. But if you're in a crisis, it's still possible to build that mechanism so that you can have a good after-action plan and to make sure you're anticipating the next piece. I guess one of the interesting situations that we were in counseling Major League Baseball in the 90s when they were having all the labor wars with the Players Association and the owners were losing all kind of credibility was we thought we would have agreement with all the owners around the table about working with the players, working on a revenue sharing plan, and really determining how we were going to try to bring that labor crisis to an end. As you might remember, many of your listeners might remember, we had to cancel the World Series that year. which was painful, and particularly to the San Diego Padres fans, because I think San Diego was on course probably to win maybe their first World Series that year, because they had such a great record, and Tony Gwynn, who's now passed away, was on a hitting streak. It was just a great time, but it's rare when you have to cancel your series, your sports penultimate event. But we thought we'd have an agreement, and then we'd have two owners come and sign, want to sign some big free agent for some big amount of money, and that kind of undercuts your credibility that the revenue system is broken in Major League Baseball because they're going to give $100 million to someone. So you got to be sure that your team is tethered at the waist, that you're all on the same hymnal with regard to messaging. And that, again, I think that early detection piece is probably the best advice I can give.
One of the things I was thinking about in preparing for this interview is that you've worked with all these extraordinary and legendary leaders. You also, as part of your diversified investment portfolio, you have a number of smaller organizations in that, like, as if I remember, parking lots and dry cleaners. And I'm curious, where do you see commonalities in leadership from those that are leading huge organizations to those leading small entrepreneurial ones?
You know, I think there are some commonalities. Obviously, some organizations are larger and publicly traded, and some are more family-owned and family-driven. And I think my curiosity has driven me to both smaller organizations and larger ones. But I think the commonality really is about leadership and culture. And whether you're a small organization or a large organization, having a common sense of culture and purpose, I think, can help a company thrive and grow no matter what your size is. So you're right. I do have investments in the hospitality hotel. We have a commercial laundry, which services Hyatts and Marriotts and Hiltons. And really, again, it kind of gets back to that relationship building that I talked about earlier. These are not investments I necessarily proactively sought. It was because they came to me first as a client to help them build some marketing and strategic expertise. And once they saw what value I brought to their businesses, and in one case, in the commercial hospitality business, which I own a small piece of, the CEO and the primary owner of that company, he bought out his family and brought me in as an investor because I helped him bring clients, helped him build his collateral material, helped him bring relationships to get additional clients, which helped to build his business. So that was quite a compliment to me. And that means this was a 15, 20-year-old business. When I came in, I didn't have to come in with the initial investment of helping to buy the equipment, the ironers, the tunnel washers, all the things you need to run a business. I came at the later stage. And I've had several different instances like that. The experiential marketing business I'm in, Think True, same thing. I didn't have to build that business. It's a 25-year-old business. But when they started a new startup, I was the person they called to actually be given a equity position in that business to help grow it, but it was based upon relationship and past performance. So if there's anything that people remember about what we talk about today is those relationships come full circle. And sometimes, again, it's about having demonstrated great performance in the past. People invite you into ventures and it can be very enriching. That's the way I actually got on the Valvoline board is Manny Jackson, who owned the Harlem Globetrotters, brought them out of bankruptcy, rebuilt them as a global brand, and later sold them to Roy Disney, his equity firm, Shamrock, obviously Walt Disney's brother. He came out to Nike, and it was he wanted to have, we had bought Converse, the brand at the time. I was involved in that deal, and Manny wanted Converse to outfit the Harlem Globetrotters for the upcoming Harlem Globetrotters 100th anniversary to wear. He wanted to go back and have them wear the old Chuck Taylor shoes and kind of recreate the spirit of 100 years ago. It didn't quite work for Converse. When we looked at the numbers, I brought in all kinds of great execs and we had a great, robust two-hour session. Didn't work from his perspective, didn't work from Converse's our perspective. We all went away friends and just kind of determined it wouldn't work. Little did I know, 3 weeks later, he was retiring from the Ashland board and had no prior relationship with Manny. The deal didn't work, so I put no money in his pocket. He went back to the leadership at Ashton and says, look, I'm retiring from this board, but I met this dynamic young executive at Nike who I think would be a great backfill for me on this board. Got the call from the CEO, did the interview, got the blessing from the board, and hence at 48 at that time in 2008, I ended up on my first publicly traded Fortune 500 board. Again, serendipitous, based upon a business venture that didn't go forward, but it's a lesson about always being prepared and never knowing who's watching when you're performing in those kind of circumstances.
Well, and I'm guessing you're not afraid to say yes.
No, that's that is true. Yes. That's also what I learned from Nelson Mandela, which I was so blessed to work with. Now, nobody media trains or advises Nelson Mandela. I mean, he's an icon and a Nobel Prize winner, but I was so blessed to have spent time with him in South Africa and in Washington. And I was really through Jody Powell and Sheila Tate. That Powell Tate was and the Kaiser Family Foundation, which had an agreement with South Africa to go to South Africa to help train and provide some policy expertise to his ANC cabinet, because he had just been elected and they were about to assume the reins of power in South Africa without having all the tools and reins of the media and corporate tools and things like that. They were assuming the reins of government. So it was just a valuable experience for me. I've met Michael Jordan, I've met LeBron James and many great luminaries in Hollywood, but to spend time with someone who spent 27 years of his life for his beliefs and his convictions and refused to renounce his beliefs is at the pinnacle of my career. It's probably the most important professional endeavor that I've ever engaged in my life, and will never forget it, and still use his leadership principles today from the Stengel book. If those of you that haven't seen it, he just gives some great leadership lessons about leading from the back and how to work with allies and bring people along that are still applicable today.
What was it like actually meeting him?
Oh my goodness! I over the years and having started in this business in my 20s, I'm not starstruck much, but just the awe and the humbling nature of being again in the presence of someone who spent 27 years incarcerated and who the whole world, not just the country, but the whole world galvanized around in terms of disinvestment in South Africa and isolating South Africa in order to effect change. Again, you just don't get those kind of experiences very often to spend time with someone like that.
What was he like?
Well, he was a humble person. He was not extroverted, not over the top. He certainly had every right to be, but very understated, very humble, enjoyed, and you could tell, obviously, he's a lawyer and a boxer. So he had the competitive spirit, but he was also intellectually grounded. And thinking about all that time he had to read, study, write during his time incarcerated, and to win over his captors and to still be the symbol and the leader of his country from behind bars. Again, those kind of leadership qualities, you can't learn it at Harvard, Yale, or Arizona State, my alma mater.
As you've looked at all these leaders, what are the things you think they most have in common that make them successful?
The ability to listen and the ability to really balance the appropriate amount of humility and allowing inclusion and input by, as we talked earlier, by even the person that might empty the trash receptacle, that might be able to socialize an idea that could be change-worthy or impactful. I think that is what I've learned, and that's something I practice today, is that I'll take a call from a student. I'll return an email from a student. I'll take a call because you never know when that idea could be impactful to you personally or to the organization that you're serving or advising or otherwise. So I think that's kind of what I take away from those experiences. And it kind of, again, all goes back to Marola being around this table at 20 years old with all these people with significantly more gray hair than I had, but all of whom I love. And one of them just actually passed away this week. I'll attend his funeral on the 29th. But again, just been very blessed and both serendipitous and blessed to have the experiences that I've had.
So we've talked a lot about what leaders should do or what we've seen with good leaders. Can you also talk to us about what you think leaders most need to let go of?
Yeah, I think a lot of leaders, and I think it's learning and business schools are, I think, trying to impart this a little bit more now amongst those. And I also chaired a board at West Point. Thank you, Sheila Tate, to kind of help their leadership, because that is the premier leadership academy. Young soldiers, after they do their 4 to 5 years of mandatory service, many of them end up being CEOs or senior leaders in corporate. But I think one of the greatest lessons that is even hard for me to learn, and I'm kind of a solo operator, is trust your people and hire good people and trust them to make the decisions. And I think the best leaders I've seen and the ones I work with around the board tables and the ones I advise do that. They hire good people. They trust them to make decisions. There's great collaborations. They're asking the right questions as a leader is important, but you got to trust your people that you hired them for a reason. And so I think that is by far one of the best lessons I've learned.
Yeah, and a good lesson for all of us, right?
Absolutely.
Well, we're all looking forward to your future contributions and seeing where serendipity takes you next. Thank you so much, Veda. This has been such an engaging conversation.
Meryl, again, thanks for having me. And you're right. You're right to point out, I don't at all take any great pride that it's me or I'm anything special. It's a combination of a lot of shoe weather, but a whole lot of serendipity and a whole lot of relationships. So thank you.
Thanks. I love talking with Veda and learning about his wide-ranging experiences over his career. Several things he said in our conversation really resonate with me. First, his story of 14,000 contacts in his phone is a good reminder about the importance of continuously meeting new people and purposefully finding small and thoughtful ways to keep them in your orbit. He also talked about how serendipity influenced a lot in his career and how he prized and valued each new experience, even when they weren't the most glamorous. The lesson I took from this is that if you embrace what life throws at you, all those experiences add up to a lot of valuable perspective over time. It was also interesting talking with Veda about Nike's operating principle to always be on the offense, which has obviously been a winning strategy for Nike. Veda said leaders can learn from Nike and help their teams be on the offense through three things: a commitment to consistent learning and experimentation, encouraging risk and not being afraid to fail, and by building an empowered culture where everyone feels they can bring new ideas to the table. Looking across all his experiences, Veda said the common link is that the most successful leaders truly work to listen to other people's ideas and perspectives. Finally, as I do with all my guests, I asked Veda what leaders should let go of. He said they need to let go of their need to behave as a solo operator and to trust the people they've hired to make good decisions. That sounds like good advice to me. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Veda. Remember to subscribe to Let Go and Lead on your favorite podcast platform and be the first to hear conversations and ideas from other thought-provoking leadership champions, including Amy Edmondson, Sally Jenkins, Mark Crawley, and Ann Powell. Thanks for joining, and see you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.